accession number 28637, Reel 4.
Parted company and I went to work for the Daily Work. I'd been sending the bits, you see. I should explain that all this time I was writing one thing and another. When I was at Unity Theatre before the war, what I did was read the plays that came in and write reports on them explaining why they were no bloody good, which most of them weren't. But, you see, some of them had something, and they writer should be encouraged, I thought. But,
yes, before you tell me about that, could I ask you a little more about being a shop steward? Because were there strikes in the shipyard?
Oh, no. The party was dead against strikes, you see, because Russia was in the war. That was the great difference, that Russia's entry into the war meant no strikes led by communists. There were strikes led by Trotsky, a strike led by dissidents of various characters, but not by communists. So, no, we always had to try to settle disputes peacefully. And so we would spend hours negotiating over grievances, which taught me a lot, of course, that it's possible to settle things by negotiation. And
yes, it must have, you must have had directions, did you, from the party?
Oh, I'm sure we did. Yes. I know. If we weren't getting directions, we were getting the line from the Daily Worker, which was legal again by then. It was banned at one point in the war by Herbert Morrison, but it was legal again by this time, and we read it carefully every day to know what we should be doing. And so that was... But after I left the shipyard, I managed to get out of doing any more war work because I had varicose veins, and it was bad, and all industrial jobs involve standing. There's very little industrial work which is done sitting down. And so I got out of the... I'm afraid that was a bit of a wrangle, but I did get into the Daily Worker, which was desperate for manpower then, because, of course, all their best chaps had been called up. And there were one or two people unfit for military service and one or two who'd been wounded in the International Brigade or other activities, but still it was pretty short of manpower. And when I went to work for the Daily Worker in April 1944, and there was a little laddie who had been invalided out of the army at the same time who went to work for the Daily Worker, and he fell madly in love with me. Now, this was a new experience. I was always the one madly in love, and the chap was being beastly to me. And here was somebody madly in love with me, and I was being beastly to him. And I was very conscious of this, but I couldn't stop myself because I could tell he hadn't got what it took to make me happy. And... a poor chap. We were both in the same job, you see. We were both reporters, and I was much better at the job than he was. And that's no basis for a marriage.
Yes, what were you reporting on?
Oh, I was having... I think when I first started off was reporting people's housing conditions. You see, this was a very fertile... ground for the party. We didn't go so far as to say that money or attention should be diverted from the war effort to building houses. There were no houses built during the war except where munition factories started up in remote areas, and there had to be houses built round them, and they were run up rather hastily to a pattern. But I reported on housing conditions in Liverpool, another eye-opener, and in the cotton towns, and I travelled all over reporting on housing conditions, and there was a, but I didn't, as I was only new to the job, they didn't put my name in the paper until there was a murder case which made a lot of headlines, and the two people had committed a murder, an American soldier and a girl of 18 from Wales had got together and joined and robbed a number of people and finally murdered a taxi driver in order to take the money. And this girl was a very bad lot. She was not a misunderstood heroine in any way. She was a genuinely bad lot. And she and the soldier were both condemned to death, but it made some stir because she was so extremely young. In those days we still had hanging. She was only just old enough to be hung. And should she be reprieved was the question. And I went to her hometown of Neath to find and wrote a piece about the conditions in which she had been grown up, living in one room with her whole family in, and described the slums of Neath. This caused the editor of the Daily Worker, Bill Rust, thought this was marvellous. He gave almost a whole page. We had paper rationing then. The Daily Worker was only 4 pages, and nearly all of one of these pages was devoted to my story about the conditions in which the murderess had grown up. It caused ructions in Neath. They said, never send Alison MacLeod here again. Because, you see, their attitude was that they had all been brought up in slums and they hadn't all committed murders, had they? And they all wanted this girl hung anyway. They were very keen on having her hung. And so the editor was confronted to his own surprise by these furious protests from me. However, he stood by me and said, in his opinion, it was a very fine story, so there. And this was Bill Rust, who was a curious character. He was, to all appearances, the absolute model of a party bureaucrat, completely inhuman and taking orders from Moscow without question. And certainly there was a lot in this. I did not know at this time that Bill Rust had a daughter living in Russia and that he was desperate to find out what the hell the Russians had done with her, which is described in the book I have left with you. She'd been deported by mistake along with the Volga Germans. A complete mistake, only she found herself on the borders of China working down a copper mine. But I knew nothing of this at the time. Bill Rust's inhuman side was obvious, but he did also have a human side. He was personally very nice to me, and he did not try to seduce me, which was his normal practice with young women, as I discovered it. And no, I knew that already. It was notorious. But Campbell, his assistant editor, was a far more decent and far more clever and articulate person than Bill Rust. Campbell was another tragedy of the lack of opportunity for education in those days. Campbell should have been at a university in his youth. Instead, he was totally self-taught. And of course, a dedicated Marxist, what else? Because people are very pleased when somebody tells them your sufferings, your struggles, your deprivations have a meaning. Let me explain to you what the meaning is. And whether they explain it in religious terms or whether they explain it in political terms, it's very acceptable to the person who has struggled and suffered. And this was one of the great strengths of the Communist Party. The Labour Party had far more mass support, of course, always, but the Communists had a dedicated elite who felt that they understood what was happening in the world. They had the complete explanation for it. And if you wanted a rational explanation for anything going on, you could ask Johnny Campbell. And
yes, I suppose that was the appeal to you as well, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, tremendously. Oh, yes. He had that an educated, even if self-educated, well, especially if self-educated, because he knew the value of education. People had to struggle for it.
Yes, it's interesting you saying about your concentration on the housing situation.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Because one imagines that the government of the day, the coalition, there wasn't a lot being done about housing, was there?
Well, they couldn't, you see. Mm. It was hard enough to get the bombed houses repaired and some sort of shelter for the people who'd been bombed out. And the government had to abandon all the pre-war regulations about overcrowding, because you couldn't enforce those once everybody was overcrowded. I mean, the people bombed out in Bath, for example, were living in conditions which would never have been tolerated before the war.
Did you have anything to do with the policy for prefabricated housing?
Oh, yes, I wrote dreams about prefabs, which were a great idea. I went to see a millionaire in Hull who had a plan for filling England from sea to sea, as it were, with prefabricated homes. Mm-hmm. He was very clever, and there was a lot in his ideas. And he got in some legal trouble. I think he had cut corners in his business, and he was had up for cooking the books. But the whole situation was so complicated that the jury let him off. But I think they couldn't make head or tail of what he had done.
What was his name?
Oh, good gracious. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Well, not to worry if you can't remember.
No, I can't remember.
No, but he was in power.
He was quite... Yes, I was... but the prefabs were a great idea. And remember, in those days, there were really still people like an old general who remarked that the troops were expecting absurd luxuries when they came back from the army, They actually thought that every family should have a bathroom. Now, the old general was a little behind the times, but only a little, because many millions of people did not have bathrooms. And I went round and looked at some of the one-room dwellings they inhabited in Liverpool and such places, and I saw how they were living. Gruesome. And the general overcrowding everywhere was terrible.
Did you see the model prefab that was set up near the Tate Gallery? Where
now,
it is
did
now?
I go to see it? It was the sort of thing I was incessantly sent to see. I'm sure I did, because we were so thrilled that the old general wasn't getting his way, and people were going to have bathrooms, and they were even going to have refrigerators, which was unheard of for the working classes. This was teensy-weensy little refrigerators, but still there'd be somewhere to keep the milk in hot weather. And this was the sort of thing that was terribly, terribly thrilling to us.
Did you also, in the Daily Worker, was there a lot of coverage of what the Red Army was doing in Europe?
Oh, well, we hoped it wasn't true. Of course, everybody knew about the Red Army's atrocities in Berlin. And of course, everybody knew what was going on, but we just hoped it wasn't true. It wasn't confirmed by our own reporters. Oh yes, there was a reason for that. The Daily Worker wasn't allowed to have a war correspondent until the war was practically over, and then a lovely character called Ivor Montagu, who was as broad as he was long, was put into a war correspondent's uniform. He did look funny, and sent off to report. And of course, Ivor Montagu was a 100% communist and wasn't going to admit the Red Army ever committed any atrocities anywhere.
I was also wondering about the good things as well, you know, how well the Red Army fought.
Oh yes, oh that we made the most of course. But I'm trying to remember how much we knew. It's terribly, when I was writing this book, I kept going back to who knew what at which date. And it's very difficult to establish who knew what at which date. When you tend to look back with hindsight, and you don't remember how little you knew at the time.
Yes, I do understand. It's one of the difficulties of this work.
Oh, you
know,
quite,
of getting,
yes.
Of memory, of separating this out. But, you know, obviously the Red Army did fight a very heroic campaign, didn't
oh,
it?
Oh, that was that was, of course, what we stressed. The Red Army's heroism, not the Red Army's atrocities when it got into Germany and how many people got raped. I remember, the rapes went on long after the actual war, because Stalin saw nothing wrong with it and wouldn't tell them not to rape German women. Stalin thought it was a jolly good thing. Some of the Russian generals were horrified, but Stalin wouldn't give the order to stop it. And
there was a coverage then of the war throughout the time, was there?
Oh, yes, oh,
but
yes,
not
yes.
From your own correspondence.
If not, yes, we were getting agency stuff about the war, and we were getting the TASS agency stuff about the war. And Oh, yes, the coverage of the actual fronts was, I think, fairly adequate. A lot of things, as I say, were left out or airbrushed out.
Yes, how about the concentration camps, the liberation of the... Because
oh, yes.
The Russians would have
that
been there
was,
very...
That was a terrific thing. Wait a minute. That happened in the very last days of the war, didn't it, when the British... I think the first were the Russians getting into the concentration camps on there. That was the first we knew about them. Yes, when the Russians got the concentration camps in their part of Germany. That we knew about. But at first people wouldn't believe it because it was... I mean, we'd believed it right away because we believed everything the Russians said. But a lot of people refused to believe it because they didn't like believing anything said by Russians. But then, of course, the British liberated Belsen and Buchenwald. I think the Americans were first in Buchenwald, but the British liberated Belsen. And so this was... and, of course, nobody could argue once that had happened that these things had really gone on.
Well, what was your circulation like during
the
war?
Oh, circulation, it was much better than ever before or since. I'm trying to remember... I think on a Saturday we would get up to 500,000 readers sometimes, but these were legendary feats of our Saturday sellers who were out in the street flogging the Daily Worker to all comers. Normally it wasn't much over. It was about 200,000 at the best.
How did you cope with the... coming election in 45.
Oh, that was very interesting because as I was travelling about the country so much in writing about housing conditions, I was always in trains. And during the war, people talked to each other in trains. After all, we were all in various forms of a terrible and appalling situation. We were all going on these long journeys which might at any moment be interrupted because the train might be stopped to let a troop train pass or something like that. And on these long journeys, chatting to soldiers and civilians, but especially to soldiers, I realised that every single soul was going to vote Labour. And they appreciated what Churchill had done. They had great respect for him as a war leader, but they did not want him as Prime Minister at the end of the war. And I came back and reported this. Now, the person who hadn't grasped this was old Stalin. Stalin had told the British Communist Party they must go for a wartime coalition to be continued at the end of the war.
End of Veal 4, Mrs. Alison Selford.